My name is Albert Kwan. I'll be talking on our work on de-anonymizing hidden services using circuit fingerprinting attack. And this is joint work between me, Michelle, and Mark, who are from Qatar, David, who is at MIT, and my advisor, Srini. So I'll first give some background information on how Tor and Tor hidden services work, just for the background, and then we'll talk about observations we made from our experiments that enabled our attacks. Now we'll talk about kind of two-pronged attacks. So the first part is that we're going to talk about how to identify if there is a hidden service activity in your network, and then we're going to talk about actually figuring out which hidden service is in your network. So the previous talk gave a pretty good overview of how Tor works, so I'll be very brief about this. So its high-level goal is to hide users' identity and activities, and it picks three onion routers, entry guard, middle, and exit, and they form what's called a circuit. And to send a message in this Tor overlay, you just onion encrypt your message for the circuit, and the exit node delivers it to the server. So, and to just point it out one more time, what this does is it protects the user's anonymity. So in this case, Alice in that picture, it would be protected. But there's the flip side to this, where sometimes the server wants to be hidden. So the server doesn't want to be found out, and this is particularly useful if you're hosting some sensitive information. So for instance, if you're WikiLeaks and you're hosting some government corruption-exposing document, you don't want to be caught, you don't want to be persecuted. If you came to my lightning talk, or if you saw the lightning talk, if you're hosting some endangered animal hairs, you don't want to be caught. So you want to hide your location, and the way Tor does this is through Tor hidden services. And usually these have the onion, so URL of .onion, so something like abc.onion. And the way it works is as follows. So first, it picks a public contact point called introduction point, or IP, which will serve as the front to your hidden service. And then it builds a Tor circuit to it. And then this is advertised through a Tor hidden service directory, and when user wants to access it, it first selects a onion router to be its rendezvous point, or also known as RP, and it builds a circuit to it and tells the hidden service, so abc.onion in this case, through the IP that RP has been set up over here. And finally, once the hidden service learns of this RP, it connects there, and now the user has a user is connected to the hidden service through many hops of Tor circuits, essentially. And here, the anonymity of both sides are protected because Tor circuits are used for every step of the connection. So just a brief reminder of what Tor wants to provide is that it wants to provide anonymity as long as not both ends of the circuits are compromised. So as previously mentioned, in the general case, if the exit node and the entry node traffic are compromised, then you lose, but otherwise you should be safe. And in this case, for hidden services, it means that the adversary needs to monitor two entry guards somehow. And this is just something to keep in mind. And for those of you familiar with Tor's system of entry guards, it's a little bit harder to perhaps actually be an entry guard or something. So maybe this is harder. And another point that's not perhaps not explicitly stated, but we would want the hidden service users of the servers to look exactly the same as regular Tor clients. Again, this is something we would want, but we'll see that that's maybe not the case. So our goal in this work was to break the hidden service anonymity as a local adversary, namely adversary observing only one end of the circuit. So we have a couple assumptions. One is that the adversary can get accurate packet information, which should be pretty straightforward, so things like direction of the packet and timing of the packet. And another assumption, maybe is perhaps a little stronger, is that adversary has circuit-level visibility, meaning they can tell circuit A apart from circuit B. So a concrete example of such adversary is a malicious entry guard. So entry guard needs to know different circuits so that they can route it to the next correct middle node, and things like that. And there are also other cases where perhaps something like network admin or the ISP is actually sufficient, but again, well, for this talk, I think I'm just going to focus on the malicious entry guard model. So that's the adversary you should have in mind. So to understand how hidden services work and what kind of vulnerabilities it has, we launched our own experiment on Live Tor Network. But we didn't use, we weren't attacking the realistic or real client or anything. We launched a couple of our own Tor clients and visited multiple websites of hidden services with it. And similarly, we also hosted our own hidden service that served cached version of different hidden services. So for obvious reasons, we can't get real data on hidden services out there, so we're just using so this was our attempt to imitate multiple hidden services just using our own. And we'll justify later in the talk why this should be, at least should give realistic data at the end. So from these experiments, we make some observations, and our attack is that first, we identify the hidden service circuits using their features. And finally, from those hidden service circuits, we're going to classify which hidden service they belong to. So here are some of the observations we made in form of cumulative distributed functions. So the first is duration of activity. So this is how long a circuit is alive for. Two things to note here. So one, the hidden service IP, which is in red, usually has CDF that's very write skewed. So most of them last over 1,000 seconds. So the reason why they're so long-lived is because they serve as a contact point for all the clients. So for availability reasons, they need to be up all the time. And there's the other extreme of the client IP shown in the solid black line, which only lasts for less than 10 seconds majority of the time. So these circuits are only used to tell the hidden service that IP is somewhere else, and the data is not communicated through that circuit, so it just dies off. So it's very short-lived. So two other interesting features we measured are the number of incoming cells and number of outgoing cells. The first thing to note is that for both IP circuits, so red and black, if you can see, on both incoming and outgoing have very little. And the reason is data is not communicated over these IP circuits, so they don't need to communicate so many cells. And another thing to note is that hidden service RP has a lot more outgoing, shown in purple here, than incoming. And the reason for this is we're monitoring servers, and usually servers receive a small request for, say, an image, and they have to send a full image back to the client, so they usually have more outgoing. So to summarize, IP circuits have some unique characteristics, and hidden service RP also has unique characteristics, namely there's a lot more outgoing than incoming. We also made some non-quantitative observations. For instance, that streams of the different dot onion domains are not multiplexed. And what I mean by this is that in general Tor, many connections actually just share one circuit, and the exit node handles a multiplexing between the endpoints. So for instance, if I'm accessing google.com and yahoo.com, they don't actually just build two circuits most of the time to access the two separately. The exit node just handles that. But in the case of hidden services, abc.onion and xyz.onion actually created totally different circuits all the time, and that's what we observed. So another one we observed is on a similar note is that IP and RP circuits are totally disjoint from everything else, so they're just special circuits and they're not shared. And finally, we also made the observation the special circuits have sometimes particular starting cell sequences, so starting packets in the beginning. This is hard to demonstrate right now, so I think an example will show up later and it will make it clear what I mean by this exactly. So using these attacks, what we wanted to do is classify the circuits that the adversary sees into five different categories, the IPs from two sides, the RPs from the two sides, and the general circuit. And so the features are exactly what I described before. So the duration of activity, the number of cells, and also the exact sequence of the first 10 cells. And finally, we used tree-based classifiers and k-nearest neighborhood classifiers. If you're not familiar with them, you don't have to worry about it so much, but tree-based classifiers just make a decision tree, and its job is to learn the shape and the exact decision at each node of the tree. So So if you're not familiar, you don't really need to know them to understand the talk. So so this is an example of an IP decision tree, meaning that it's a decision tree used to decide hidden service IPs, client IPs, or other. So don't worry, if it's hard to read, what's important is that it's very small, and namely it has 19 nodes and 10 leaves. So it has 19 different decisions it needs to make, and only 10 different ways to arrive at a final decision. So here's a more human legible version of the tree. So the way to read the tree is that if it's taking the left branch, that means it satisfied that decision. If it's taking the right branch, then it didn't. So some interesting paths here, for instance, are that if the duration of activity is less than 1.96 seconds, that it got classified as client IP, which is exactly what I described before, that they're extremely short-lived. Another similar one is that if the number of incoming, or number of outgoing, sorry, is less than 4, and number of incoming is also less than 4, then it's likely to be client IP. So this again makes sense because no data is transmitted over the IP circuits. But if the outgoing is, number of outgoing is small, but if the number of incoming is potentially large, then it got classified as hidden service IP. And the reason for this is the hidden service only needs to build a circuit once to the IPs, and it may potentially receive a lot of RP locations depending on number of clients connecting to you. So it does a very good job of identifying in a very simple manner. And here's a similar tree for deciding which RP it is. This one's a little more complicated because the features come in, or the sequences come into play. Again, the thing to note here is that there are 17 nodes and only 9 leaves. And here's an abridged version of the tree, which is extremely right skewed. But really the interesting thing is that if the number of outgoing is larger than 25, so it's fairly large, then it's likely to be hidden service RP. And perhaps more interesting thing, though, is that if you start as one of these three sequences, then you're going to be client RP, and this immediately decides you. So what exactly are these sequences? They look like this, and it just looks like, you know, I, whatever. To understand this, we have to actually understand which cells are used to establish a circuit in the beginning for Tor. So this is the circuit construction phase of Tor for general circuit and client RP circuits. So in the case of general circuits, what happens is there's an outgoing cell, incoming cell, and outgoing incoming. So it's just zigzag. But in case of client RP, there are these, I'm not sure if you can see the red, but there's these three special cells that are associated with rendezvous point. And as soon as those three are identified, the classifier can immediately say those are client RPs. So, as I mentioned before, these circuits have very particular starting patterns, and that's very identifying. So we collected some data on different IPs and RPs and other circuits, and we ran the tree-based classifier, which is C4.5 and CART, and also the KNN algorithm. And we saw that all algorithms performed pretty well. So for IP classification, it had true positive rate over 95% for all of them, meaning that everything that was actually IP got correctly identified as that IP. And it also had very low false positive rate, below 1% for IP, client IP and hidden service IP. And for RP classification, it performed similarly well for the true positive rate, but the false positive rate for the client RP was slightly higher at about 2%. But even so, we believe that this is, since the algorithm is so simple, it actually does a reasonable job of identifying the circuits really fast. And we also had another attack, but for sake of time, I think I'll skip over it. But if you're interested, I'll be happy to talk more about it. So far, like the circuit classification attack actually tells you whether there is a hidden service activity present in your network. Namely, it can tell you whether there's an IP or an RP circuit and which side it's on. But perhaps that's not as useful as actually figuring out which hidden service is associated with which circuit. So to do that, we go back to the website fingerprinting attack that's been gaining popularity recently. So The website fingerprinting attack is a very similar style of attack as the one I just described. So it allows a local adversary to de-anonymize a user through traffic analysis sort of thing. And it classifies the websites using the features similar to the ones I described before. And there has been a lot of work on this recently, and some of the more recent work perform really well, at least in their experiments. They get above 80% accuracy, below 1% false positive rate. So they've been getting a lot of attention. But they've also been getting a lot of criticisms. Namely, there was a paper at last year's CCS by Juarez et al. That demonstrated some of the points. And so I'm going to highlight some of them here. So first is that any data you're going to collect is likely to be noisy. So you're never going to get a clean data for Google.com, for instance. The data you're going to see is a mixture of Google and Yahoo and whatever application and tabs the user has open at a time, because they're multiplexed for the general Tor circuits. Another criticism was the size of the world on these experiments are generally very small. So most experiments done only include less than 10,000 websites, and most include only like 5,000 websites at most. And considering there's actually millions and billions of websites, maybe we haven't tested on enough, so we don't really know if it will work. And that was another criticism. And finally, another important one that we thought was important, at least, was that the website contents change really rapidly. So what we mean by that is that, for instance, they change from day to day. If you're a news website, then your news is going to be different from day one to day two. Google Doodle differs every day, for instance, and things like that. Another source of difference is if different users are logged in. So if I logged in as Alice on Facebook versus Bob on Facebook, then the news feed I'm going to get is different, so I'm going to see different data. And finally, another one is like location-based services, where if I log in as Google in US versus Google in Switzerland, then I'm going to see different Google, so maybe the contents will again be different. So all these facts have demonstrated that the accuracy drops significantly in a realistic settings, and the CCS paper does this really well and demonstrates it. However, what we think is that some of the criticisms pointed out are not really applicable in domain of hidden services. So for instance, the hidden service circuits are not shared, so all the data we're going to get are really clean. So if we want abc.onion, we're going to get abc.onion. So that's point one. Second, the size of the world is significantly smaller. So according to the Tor Metric website, there's about 30,000 unique Tor hidden.onion addresses, which is a lot smaller than number of .com addresses, for instance. And if you only consider the popular hidden services, like Silk Road, the New Black Market, WikiLeaks, DuckDuckGo, whatever, they're probably only in a couple thousands. So it's really not inconceivable that the adversary actually collects data on all these websites, because there's only a few thousand of them. And finally, hidden service pages really don't change very much. And to demonstrate this point, we collected the content and downloaded the website over 8 weeks, and we measured the similarity over the weeks. So one means that they're identical, and zero means that they're totally different. So over the 8 weeks, more than 50% of the website stayed exactly the same. And this makes sense because things that usually cause websites to change, things like user behavior or location-based data, are not available to Tor hidden services because users should be anonymous and location should be unknown. So given these three facts, we really think that website fingerprinting is more damaging to hidden services and thus more serious. So to demonstrate the effectiveness of this attack, we performed our own experiments of website fingerprinting on hidden services. We had 50 sensitive hidden services and 950 non-sensitive hidden services, where 50 included some of the more popular ones, but we won't disclose the name for ethical reasons, and 950 sort of random ones and some of the more popular ones as well. So, and the reason why the world is so small, we actually collected data for a lot more, but most of them were not either not up or compromised by the FBI, actually, so we couldn't get that much data. So to train the classifier, we gave it 50 instances of the 50 sensitive hidden services and one instance of varying number of non-sensitive hidden services. And so the client was allowed to visit any of the 1,000 pages, and classifier's job was to classify them into which of the 50 hidden services did it visit, or which of the sensitive ones did it visit, or did it visit non-sensitive ones. And we had a similar task for the servers, where the servers served one of the 1,000 pages, and the classifier's job was to figure out which one it was serving. And to do this, we use our own hidden service with cached pages, as mentioned before. And the reason why we think this is actually realistic data, or in some sense it represents the worst case data, is because the websites don't change. So just by the fact that we're serving cached pages, like, we actually should be getting pretty realistic data. And again, we use tree-based classifiers and KNN classifier to actually test the algorithm. So so this graph shows the accuracy for classifying which website the client visited, so the client accuracy. And you can see that most algorithms perform about just as well. And so the true positive rate is well above 80%. And the false positive rate goes as low as 2.9%, depending on the number of these non-sensitive hidden services that we give it to the training, the classifier. And similarly, for classifying which server was serving the page, you can see that the true positive rate is equally high, or even higher in some cases, ranging from 80 to 96%. And the false positive rate goes down as low as 9.6%. Or sorry, 7.9%. And the reason why we think the false positive rate is so much higher here is because we're actually using just one server. So that things, other identifying features like the operating stack or like which Apache version you're using are not accounted for, so maybe that's why it can't do as good of a job. And also, I'd like to note that this was done through Weka, which is an open source machine learning tool. And so it's a very basic tool, and we use very basic features. So if we launch a more complicated attack, as proposed by the previous website fingerprinting community or literature, I think we'll get even better results. So this really represents the worst that an adversary could do potentially. So we actually thought of a couple of defenses, at least have done some thought experiments with them and with some scripts. And so for circuit classification, the obvious thing to do would be to obfuscate the features. So the features we use, such as duration of attack, number of incoming and outgoing cells, things like that. And so, you know, so maybe the circuits should live just as equally long as others, and maybe you should use padding cells to make number of incoming and outgoing cells similar to everything else. And website fingerprinting, to defend against website fingerprinting, we think multiplexing multiple RP circuits with each other, or maybe even with general circuits, if that's possible somehow, would actually help tremendously, as demonstrated by Juarez et al. In last year. And also, there's a lot of website fingerprinting defenses out there, namely the one by Wang et al. Last year at Usenix Security is also directly applicable here. So in conclusion, we show that website hidden service connections are fingerprintable, and they demonstrate a very particular set of features. And website fingerprinting is more realistic in hidden services, at least we believe so. And we've demonstrated this effectiveness of the two-prong attack, where we first identify these hidden service circuits, and then we identify which hidden service it's associated with. And finally, our data is available at this URL. If you email us, then we'll be happy to point you to that URL again. So thanks, and I'll take any questions.
We have time, once again, for a few questions for Albert. I see Roger and Rob coming up.
Rob Jansen, NRL. Thanks for the great talk. You mentioned that a lot of the websites didn't change over time. And I'm wondering, there was a talk earlier today by Kyle Soska from CMU indicating that every time he visited a Silk Road page, it actually changed. So that was very dynamic. So I'm wondering if you looked at the difference in the traffic instead of just the number of websites, and if you have any data on that.
And we don't have the data offhand, but we can definitely compute it from the data we have, at least. I guess our point was the majority of the websites stay, but some websites, such as marketplaces or news websites or things like that, will change dynamically, and maybe in those cases, it won't be as effective.
Yeah, so that's an interesting question where, as far as I understand, you looked at the front page of each of these 1,000 services?
That's correct, yeah.
And there are people out there with data sets of a million pages from hidden services or something, many of them from forums and other things where there are a lot of more dynamic and more complicated pages inside. Mm-hmm. So I guess just like every website fingerprinting paper, the question is, okay, it works great for the 1,000 that you start with. What does the graph look like as you go from 1,000 to the other million to the other 5 million? It would be wonderful if the set of pages in hidden service land is tiny and static, but in practice right now it seems to be larger and dynamic than at least this classifier can handle.
So that's a valid question, I think, for any website fingerprinting sort of attacks, but at a So I'd like to actually review one of the points. Most people start by visiting the front page, right? They don't often just go into the particular forum page they are interested in. So, and if the user think time dominates, then I could, for instance, at least identify, you know, the first page and just use the data for that. So in that sense,
Yes, except if I'm, so you're looking for the front page signature of me going to xyz.onion, mm-hmm. But actually I'm looking through the forum over here and loading some other page generates a signature that looks just like xyz.onion. So in fact, because of all these other pages' existence and people going to them, they could induce false positives where you think that there are only 1,000 pages and you're sure it's this one when actually it's these other million that are generating very similar signatures.
I think that's a fair point, but again, I think we have to do some studies to actually see, and we can't answer the question on the spot right now. But yeah, thanks for the question.
So you mentioned that you looked at 50 of the hidden services, mm-hmm. the sensitive hidden services,
yep.
out of like 950 of the rest.
Yep.
Why did you choose 50, and how did you choose those 50? And did you consider looking at different sets from, you know, 50 to 100 to 150,
so,
how did that affect the results?
So in terms of amount of data we had, like, so we tried to collect data from like 3,000 or so hidden services, and literally thousands of them were either not up or FBI compromised, so they weren't good sets to work with. So of the 1,000, like, I tried running it with 50 sensitive ones, or, you know, 100 sensitive ones, and we saw, you know, pretty much no difference, and we thought that the smaller the number of sensitive ones there are, the more powerful the attack would be in practice, for instance. So like that just reduces the load on the adversary to have to collect data on, you know, many data on these ones. So for instance, yeah, I only need to collect 2,500 websites versus 5,000 websites. Right. So we wanted to kind of keep that small and see what that does to the classifier.
Hi, I was wondering, so you have two pieces of your attack, one of which is the, detect that it's a hidden service and then figure out which one.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important to do that, and you kind of have error rates for each of your classifiers. But the detect which circuit it is, I mean, 97% of Tor traffic is not hidden services. So those, have you looked at your, like, sort of total error rate? Because it seems like the errors in that classifier, even though it's a better classifier, are going to dominate. So, like, my back of the envelope calculation is that about half of your false positives are going to be some website out there that isn't even a hidden service. So I was wondering if you've done that analysis, and as a result of that, it seems that the defenses that make that attack, that part, harder, are going to be much more effective than any website fingerprinting defense.
So I think that's right. So we haven't done that analysis, or that exact analysis, but yeah, we certainly have thought about how the effects compounds, exactly like you said. And I think it will be that bad, but for instance, if you're just interested in classifying IPs, so for instance, hidden service IP classification has extremely high true positive rate and very low false positive rate. So like well below 0.1% even, right? So for those, and so then now you know that this service is actually, or this Tor client is hidden service, then any circuit that goes out of it is likely to be hidden service RP. So then you actually have pretty close to 100% accuracy of figuring out what hidden service RPs are. So the accuracy that we demonstrated is if you classify them separately, but if you actually start compounding the two information together, you may actually even do better. But I agree with what you say, that if you actually make the error rate really high on the first part of our tech, then your data collection and your error rate compound and all these things will make everything worse in this situation. So that would be more effective.
All right, let's thank Albert again.
Thanks.